Hello, this is Stephen Janis, and I'm here with my reporting partner, Taya. Taya, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for asking.
So this is going to be kind of a special edition of the Police Accountability Report podcast. We're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to be talking about an idea that both Taya and I discuss a lot, but don't always have the right story to fit into to kind of create the sort of intellectual framework to explain it. Mm-hmm. So first, let me say that this podcast is going to be about something we call bullshit crimes. But the way we're going to tell the story and explain it is not simply just to say what a bullshit crime is, because I'm sure you can kind of think of what that
is. I'm sure you can guess.
But we're going to tell it through a story that we've been covering for 5 years. But before we get to that story, I just want to talk a little bit about a concept that fits into this idea of bullshit crimes. And it's something that, Tay, you brought up in your last show called hegemonic policing. So if you don't mind, could you give us a little bit of idea of what hegemonic policing is and what it says about law enforcement in the U.S. right now?
Absolutely. Where credit is due, the concept of hegemonic policing was generated by Stephen Janis. Mm. When you talk about hegemony, you're talking about dominance. And hegemonic policing is a form of policing where the imperative isn't public safety, but the imperative is actually to project power. Mm. And that is power socially, power politically. To control, not just control the public, but to control the narrative the public receives as well. So hegemonic policing is a projection of power as opposed to public safety.
Right. And so the reason we use this sort of critical context is to bring, like I said, remove us from the immediate so we can look at policing in a sort of an ahistorical way, not divided from history, but the sense that we understand that maybe there's some things that are happening that just shouldn't be. So the reason I brought this up is because there was a development in the story that we've been covering for 5 years, and actually we did a documentary about involving the first black police chief of Pocomoke City. His name is Kelvin Sewell. He served as police chief from 2011 to 2015, and he implemented a very popular and effective form of community policing that was sort of opposed to all the drug war ethos. Tay, can you tell us a little bit about what he did?
Well, what's funny is that with Kelvin's form of policing, which is a type of community policing, it was as simple as one could possibly hope. Mm. One of the first things he did was he asked his officers to get out of their cars and walk through the community and talk to residents. Now, I'm sure you're listening and you're like, this doesn't sound revolutionary, but he had to let his officers know. Initially, they pushed back against this, and he said, I'm the chief of police. If I'm getting out of my car, parking it, and walking, so are you. Mm. And so you would think, well, what's going to be generated from going out and talking and walking? But well, the thing happened is that they got to know the community better. They got to know who was doing well, who was up to mischief, as they like to call it. So they got to find out what was actually going on in the community. And even more importantly, they actually established a relationship with the community. Officers, right? I know, shocking, right? The officers knew who the people were that they were supposed to be protecting and serving. And so that changed the relationship of the police department with the community, and it was actually effective. Crime dropped by 80%. During Kelvin's tenure of 4.5 years, there wasn't a single homicide.
So there had been at least one or two during that period of time, yeah.
Right. So so this was actually an effective form of policing, and something that always stood out to me is that this chief of police actually gave people his cell phone number, which I thought was amazing, that your everyday resident could call the chief of police on their cell phone number and contact them. And he told me that he would know about a crime before it was committed, and he would get 2 or 3 phone calls of people knowing who was going to do it, when it was going to happen, and where. So he was able to prevent crime from happening.
Yeah. So the reason we brought that up is because after he did this, he was fired by the city council. It became a big controversy. The black community supported him, but the white council wouldn't tell them why they fired him. And eventually, Kelvin filed a lawsuit, which he won, alleging discrimination from the city council and from other various members of the Worcester County Law Enforcement, which is where he was, which is a small sort of county in lower Maryland Eastern Shore, which includes Pocomoke City. But what has happened since is that during that same period of time when he was filing his discrimination lawsuit and he was claiming discrimination and filing EEOC complaints, the Maryland State Prosecutor opened up a huge, huge investigation, far-reaching, interviewing all sorts of people about all sorts of, I would say, baseless allegations about him. And, you know, for example, Tay, you spoke to a woman who said that they interviewed her and asked if she had had sex with Kelvin, right?
Right. This was an interview we did with a woman named Jerry Fitch, and she was actually interviewed by the police officers when she was in prison. She was actually mm-hmm. there on charges of drug dealing. And so while she's in prison, separated from her children, a couple officers come in and ask her if she had had sexual relations with Kelvin, the chief that we're talking about. And she said, no, she didn't. And they told her, well, it was some sort of urban legend that you had a relationship with him. She said, that is untrue. I have no relationship with him. And then they said, well, if you were to talk about having a sexual relationship with him, we might be able to help you out. And she said they essentially implied, if you scratch my back, we'll scratch yours.
Right.
And that it could affect her prison stay and how long she'd have to be in prison. So they were giving her an opportunity to just exaggerate or just straight out lie about your relationship with this police officer, and you'll go free
and
early.
And that eventually they settled on charges of related to a 2014 accident involving two parked cars. Pocomoke Corrections officer, who happened to be African-American, was driving home one night, fell asleep at the wheel, drove into two parked cars, and then drove three blocks home and called police. Police show up and conduct an investigation, and insurance forms are filed. Accident report is filed. You know, no one ever said anything about it. But then suddenly the state prosecutor indicts Kelvin Sewell for misconduct in office. And the thrust of the prosecutor's case is that Kelvin interfered with an accident investigation because the man who got in the accident with the car, with the two parked cars and no property damage, I mean, no bodily damage, was a black Mason, right, Taya?
Right. Well, the thing is that he belongs to this Masonic lodge, and Kelvin happens to also be a Mason. But there was no community. They weren't friends. They didn't know each other.
There was no evidence.
The prosecutors pulled phone records, etc. There was no evidence of text between them or anything like that, or phone calls. So
right.
Trying to prove that they had any sort of friendship or relationship just didn't work.
So the state prosecutor decides that, hey, this is a crime and this is worth prosecuting, and goes through this huge process of indicting him in a grand jury, a trial. Kelvin loses down in Worcester County, which was not surprising. Was it surprising to you?
Not in the least.
Right, because it's all white jury, and I think they basically wanted, the fix was in. This is Worcester County. And then after Kelvin wins his appeal, the Court of Special Appeals rules that he, in fact, did not receive a fair trial because an expert witness was denied by the judge who would have testified that Kelvin was exercising officer discretion. He goes back to try. They go back down to Worcester County to try it again. But this time there's some allegations sort of surrounding it that one of the witnesses, Tanya Barnes, who testified that Kelvin was behaving unusually that night, had lied and had encountered Kelvin up in Baltimore City and said, look, I lied because prosecutors were actually pressuring me because they said I'd stolen some money. And we actually found notes when we went through the records that actually confirmed this, that she that the state prosecutor's investigators thought she was perhaps an unreliable witness. And so there seemed to be a lot of evidence, but again, all that was excluded, and Kelvin was convicted again. And now the Court of Special Appeals has come up with a new ruling saying that there should be a hearing about about prosecutorial misconduct. It's very complex, but the bottom line is Kelvin's only way to win now is if he goes back down to Worcester County and fights with prosecutors over this idea that prosecutors committed misconduct. And wins that. And if he wins that, guess what? He gets another trial. And before I get into what I really want to talk about, I just want to tell Taya, can you explain to people why he will never win in Worcester County?
Wow. Well, there's a long version and a short version. The short version is it's the old boys network. If you, that the law enforcement officers and the criminal justice system down there, essentially, all these people know each other, all these people protect each other, and that if you're not a part of their club and they feel you've wronged one of their members, you're not going to see justice in their court systems down there.
Right. So where does that leave us? Well, the reason we brought this up and we put you through this whole story about this trial is because this is a perfect example of what Tay and I like to talk about, our bullshit crimes. Excuse me for swearing, but that's what they are. You know, you're talking about a 2014 accident involving two parked cars, and now prosecutors have probably spent $500,000 to $1 million. And much of what we see in our reporting are so-called bullshit crimes. And the reason I call them bullshit crimes is actually sort of an homage to a very, you know, a favorite of our show and a favorite of people at The Real News, the late David Graeber, who was an outstanding, I guess you'd call him anthropologist, sociologist, mm-hmm. who wrote some tremendous books. And one of his books was about bullshit jobs and how destructive they were. Yes. His basic thesis was that, you know, we kind of invent jobs that don't really accomplish anything. And it's a way of sort of redistributing wealth upwards. It's a way of giving power to people to sort of become hegemonic in a way. Mm-hmm. It's a way of creating sort of a raison d'etre for income inequality, and saying, you know, this guy who's the social media manager for this nonprofit making $120,000 really deserves this because this is such an important job, when Graeber would make the actual argument that it was bullshit. And actually, if you want to watch his explanation, you can go to therealnews.com and you can put his name in. You'll see he actually explains some of the jobs, which I can't like list right now. But the point being that this is very closely tied to hegemonic, because these arrests that we see, these cases, I have seen over and over again in my life, bullshit cases and bullshit crimes. There was a report by the ACLU in 2010 that Maryland spent $110 million a year on marijuana prosecutions and arrests. Now, Taya, wow. You were nice enough to take me in one time into a marijuana dispensary. What was in there?
In the marijuana dispensary, mm-hmm. there was marijuana. and it was being sold safely to the public.
And someone was profiting, which in this case in Maryland means that white people were profiting, right?
Right. It seems essentially that the distribution of marijuana, which in a majority black city like Baltimore, in great part was handled, I would say the retail side was handled by African Americans. Now there is a group of white business owners who are dominating the distribution of marijuana here in Maryland. And they have found a way to profit on what was considered a crime previously, cost people their livelihoods, cost people years of their lives, cost them their freedom.
Now, we have many examples of bullshit crimes that we have covered. And the reason I want to bring this up and bring it up in tandem with hegemonic policing is because I think it is very similar to Graeber's thesis that these bullshit crimes are actually quite destructive because they create artificial sense of power. Now, let's talk about Otto the Watchdog, which we will be updating people on this, but if you listen to our podcast, you kind of get a preview of this. Otto the Watchdog, who is a person who's a well-known auditor that we've interviewed before, he had held some signs and out that some people found offensive, and they arrested him for, which seems absolutely un-American. And then he showed up for his trial with his kids. He was camping, and someone called, and he got arrested again, right, Taya?
Right. Otto was out camping with his kids, and I would say a concerned Karen called the police, and the police officers show up. It's nighttime. They flash the lights into the camper. The kids are terrified, and essentially, a dad was out, you know, camping with his kids, and they managed to turn it into a felony.
And he was charged with two felonies, correct? And,
yes.
And how this has dragged on for a long time.
This has dragged out for years. And of course, it hasn't just cost him money. And it has, because he's had to travel from Colorado to Texas for these court dates, which cost gas money, time, etc. But it's also cost him a great deal, you know, emotionally, psychologically, because during this process, he's been separated from his children. Mm. And of course, the wear and tear of not knowing whether or not you're going to end up in prison
right.
for years.
Now, the good news, there is some good news, though, right?
Absolutely. Charges have been dropped.
And that is good. But as a point you made, you did a very powerful interview with him, and you saw the pain, right? That this years of separation from his children have caused.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's so difficult to listen to a father talk about his children and how much he misses them, and to see the pain in his face and to see the pain that he's endured being separated from his kids. And on top of it, to have to try to explain to his children why he can't see them. You know, he's been paying for, you know, an ankle monitor, which takes up, you know, a big chunk of his money. Can you imagine paying $300 a month for it to be surveilled for a crime you didn't commit? I mean, that's. And so there's been a lot of just so much stress on him. So I'm very happy for him that these BS charges have been dropped.
And, you know, we both of us live in a city that pretty much made a manufacturing process out of bullshit crimes, because we had a process called, or a strategy called, zero tolerance, where people were arrested for you know, thousands of people arrested for spitting on a sidewalk, you know, drinking
or
beer.
Yeah, having an open container of beer, even if you're sitting on a porch, people urinating in an alley. But even more egregiously, people were being arrested for not being able to provide ID. If you're in a neighborhood that they considered a high crime or a high drug neighborhood, which is most of the neighborhoods in Baltimore City, the police officer would stop you, ask you if you belong there, and then ask you for your ID. And if you couldn't provide it or said you didn't want to, that was a trip to central booking for you.
And the havoc it wreaked on people's lives is, I think, is very akin to what David Graeber was talking about, and that is the sense that this vacuum of power that has real no productive social outcome. In other words, the arrests that we've seen, whether it be Otto the Watchdog and now this case against Kelvin Sewell, does not have a public safety outcome. I mean, let's remember, Sewell reduced crime. Sewell fought back against the drug war. Sewell improved the community, and yet he has been prosecuted for 5 or 6 years. And just full disclosure, we tried to interview Tonya Barnes in Sewell's presence when, and that's the name of the witness that was the problematic witness, after Sewell had told us that she had come to him and said, look, I didn't want to say what I said, but prosecutors threatened me. We tried to interview her, and now I'm in part of the investigation. They keep citing me.
Right.
And, you know, so not only did they go after Sewell for 6 years, but they've included me in it. I had to have a lawyer and deal with this. And to what end? To what end does any of this, none of this, contributes to public safety? And yet we sit here and have this debate about support the police, defund the police, but never really ask what we want police to do. Now, in this city, in Baltimore, you know, usually I've done stories about the clearance rate of homicides being in the 20s and the 30%. That means that 60 or 7% of people who commit murder in this town are walking around. I once did a story, an investigation with my former colleague, Luke Broadwater, that looked at thousands of unsolved homicides. I mean, we were talking thousands. That means, wow, there are thousands of murderers walking around. Why on earth is the state of Maryland spending millions to prosecute an accident for two parked cars? It is
That's a good question.
It is exactly what I call it, bullshit. But this is not the first time. I mean, why did prosecutors spend 3 to 4 years hounding Otto the Watchdog, taking his shoulder away? Mm-hmm. And didn't Otto have to wear an ankle bracelet?
Absolutely. He had to wear an ankle bracelet and pay for the privilege.
Right. I mean, it was like $300 a month.
Absolutely. $300 a month.
So why? What exactly did you accomplish with Otto the Watchdog? So now he won't hold his sign up saying shit is fucked up and stuff? I mean,
right.
I don't know.
And honestly, that seemed to me to be a clear-cut First Amendment case. Mm-hmm. He was holding a simple fine sign saying, and pardon the language, shit is fucked up and stuff. And then they had another sign, I think it was maybe even on the back of the same sign, saying the system isn't going to fuck itself. And he was holding these signs at the same time while distributing free food to people.
The problem is that criminal justice, almost bullshit crimes, are almost worse than bullshit jobs in the sense of being destructive, because we have seen the way the pain that bad policing, how it radiates through people's lives, how it affects other people, how, you know, there was a man in Texas, another man in Texas, Randall Thompson, who got pulled over and charged with, he had bought a car at police auction, got pulled over when he drove it off the lot. They found some, I think it was meth in it.
Yes.
One thing of meth.
Yes, a baggie with a little bit of methamphetamine in it.
And, they raked him over the coals for 2 years, facing two felonies. Fortunately, those charges were dropped, too. I don't know what it has to do with us, but the point being that it is so socially destructive. There is no check and balance. Everyone thinks that law enforcement should have full discretion. I disagree. I have seen the state prosecutor, what they've done to Kelvin. I have seen, you know, what this prosecutor has done in Texas. And, you know, we keep encountering stories like this. And I think the problem is that we have too much focus on bullshit crimes in this country. Crimes that are really meant to convey power, right, that are meant to convey hegemony, that are meant in a sense to be self-serving, in the sense that they serve the increase of the bureaucracy of law enforcement. In other words, you know, we arrested 100 people for spitting on a sidewalk. We just looked at the city, Brenton in Texas, where a man named Brad Naylor ended up having police break a door to get into his house with no pretext, no warrant, no Fourth Amendment, no probable cause, and then lie about it because he got the body cam footage, which showed that, in fact, the police said that the door was unlocked and they just walked in, but in fact, they broke in, and they broke in with their guns drawn. But it was interesting. I was looking at the stats there's barely any crime, but there's this huge police department, 17,000 people, 65 police employees, and they kept pulling, they were pulling like 6, 7, 10,000 people over a year in a city of 17.
How many million was the police department's budget?
Yeah, it was like 7 or 8 million in the whole budget. It was like almost 40. That was public safety. There could be, but I don't think they have a
professional. But a $7 million budget for a town of 17,000 people.
Right, exactly.
That's quite a bit.
So you know, it's self-perpetuating. And the story we talked about with Brad Naylor, who lives in this town, you know, the police like came up to his house. They saw a car with a bunch
of was all on the pretext of the smell of marijuana, which has led to so many violations.
You're right. But the first pretext was they saw a car with personal possessions in it. It was even more bizarre. If you look at the narrative, first he talks about that. And then you're right. Then when that seems kind of absurd, then he's like, oh, but there was marijuana. So someone had some toilet paper in their car. And you made a great point when you asked the question, which I thought was a great point. You're like, this was 5 o'clock in the morning.
Right. 5 o'clock in the morning in Texas. Was it the best idea to bang on someone's door and then kick it in?
But I like the other point you made. You said, what time did he smoke the marijuana?
Because if this was 5 o'clock in the morning, he would have literally had to been smoking marijuana at 4:50 in the morning.
Right.
For there to be a possibility for someone to still smell it outdoors.
Yeah.
So that seemed a very flimsy pretext at best. But to bust into a house in Texas where you know two men are stationed and not be worried that they're willing to exercise their Second Amendment rights, I think it's a pretty dangerous thing to do.
Yeah, undoubtedly. But also an example of why policing doesn't just need to be reformed, it needs to be rethought. Philosophically speaking, it is flawed. I think beyond repair in this country. I
think that echoes partially from the roots of policing. I mean, when you talk about like pretextual crimes or bullshit crimes, I mean, this starts, you know, right after the Civil War when the slaves were freed. And so there were literally bullshit crimes. Vagrancy laws were enacted.
That is such a good point.
So African-American people who were recently freed could be jailed and imprisoned for no reason and then put to work for free again in chain gangs,
you're so right.
Working on farms as laborers again. So there is a history of social control and the use of bullshit crimes to control groups of people. And now it's just
monetize
expanded. And to monetize those same people. And now we've just seen other ways it's expanded.
Yeah. Well, we won't keep you forever, but I do appreciate you taking the time to explain some of this to us. And we
of
will
course,
keep on this to. Idea of bullshit crimes, because if there's any news organization that will report on your bullshit crime, it'll be
Stephen and Tay at the Police Accountability Report.
Right.
If your civil rights and your civil liberties are being violated, you think you've been the victim of a bullshit crime, we care about it.
Okay.
And we'll try to help you tell your story.
And just to keep in tradition of the Police Accountability Report, my name is Stephen Janis, but I'll let Taya sign out.
Well, this is Stephen Janis and Taya Graham of the Police Accountability Report. Thank you for joining us, and please be safe out there.